Interview with Manders, RHD, 6th of January, 1966.
People happen to have visited Ceylon holiday, and they were very much enchanted with it.
Interview is overlaid and erased by interview with Baker. Continues now.
Did the villagers complain that did you find that the villagers and the planters were squabbling over a piece of land, both sides claiming it?
Oh, yes, that would occasionally happen, yes. Mm-hmm.
Not very often, I suppose.
To a minor degree. Mm-hmm. But, yes, when you mention things like that, when you said, first of all, was there a lot of causes of friction between the planters and the villagers. I mean, I imagine on the whole they all got on quite well and nobody hated the other, but I suppose all these sort of little things were going on all the time with their dispute, stray cattle and encroachments and things like that, and rights of way through the estates and that sort of thing. Yes, but just as I suppose in any community you could get there, but don't think it constituted a cause of serious, not of hatred anyhow between them. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned these European clubs. You felt that the Ceylonese disliked these clubs and the planters, did you?
The Ceylonese resented purely European clubs. Mm-hmm. Now even the Martley Club was European when I was there. If Ceylonese had a Ceylonese club in England, you wouldn't resent it quite that. But it was a pity because it was sort of misinterpreted and it sort of. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel it was wise to have these European only clubs?
Well, no, it wasn't really. I mean, I think that's perhaps one of the things some people said that that's really what caused the end of the British Empire, the European clubs, and it wasn't doing a bit too strongly, but it was resented. Gradually they were going out at the end. I mean, in a place like Maddle Kelly, you wouldn't dream of having a European club. But Martley, it still was, I think, even when I left. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sympathise with the English people liking to occasionally sort of get together with their own people, just as there was a Cingalese club in Colombo. But in the circumstances, of course, it's definitely, looking back tonight, what was a pity, because it was misinterpreted as sort of being a kind of...
It's a sensitive issue, but it's very interesting that Stace, who's a philosopher by nature, writing of an earlier period, raises as one of the major criticisms of British rule in Ceylon what he calls arrogance of the. This refers not only to officials but to the whole community as a whole. And would you comment on that?
Well, I'm afraid it must be true of the earlier days, and I suppose there's some of it still left in my time. I think that I don't think.
There were some deliberate slights, semi-conscious, shall I say, slights were there, even in your time? I mean, by planters
Yes, well, things always happen that one would think were wrong. I mean, I can't think of any particular. Mm-hmm. Well, but sort of things used to happen. Well, some English lady playing at wherever it was, somewhere in Colombo, the Ceylonese, she sort of had to go back to the garden club and he couldn't come there or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sort of thing, which... And, I mean, well, I mean, in all communities you get all kinds, and then you get the English people who know how to behave and the ones that don't, I suppose.
Yes, of course, the thing about this sort of thing is the stories, when these slides occur, they spread and it becomes a general belief. And then people see, imagine slides where there are no slides too.
Yes.
And the thing snowballs, more or less.
Yes. But I suppose it must be confessed that the English people, when they first went out there, I suppose they considered themselves a superior race. And the feeling sort of died hard.
Well, presumably they had greater assurance and confidence than most of the Ceylonese.
Yes.
And well, this would have been noticeable in their relations.
Yes.
I haven't really come up to tackled a non-political aspects pertaining to land, which is fairly interesting. And also there's a headman system. What did you think of the headman system?
Well, when I left, I didn't see how they could do without it.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my grouses against politics. They were always attacking this headman system. And
yes, for what reasons? I mean, have you any inkling what motivated these politicians? Jealousy?
Well, I rather think that as long as the headman was there, he was a sort of power, and he was the person on whom we, the officials, the government agents, largely relied. And I suppose the politician liked to feel that they relied on him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's... I mean, of course, there were obviously... They were bad headmen.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was our job to try and see that there weren't any. And we took a lot of care in appointing them. And it was our job to get rid of them when we did find out they were bad. And it was the job of the community and the politicians to try and bring it to our notice. And it really was the sort of basis of the government, really.
Did you trust the headman when it came to land matters, for instance? Could you trust them?
Yes, of course, as government said, you must never trust anyone, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, I think so, on the whole.
I think this is running out. Did you have anything to do with Gansabas?
The village committees and the village tribunals.
No, the committees.
Oh yes, village committees. Yes. Of course, when I went out first, the Ratamahatnias were the chairman of the village committees ex officio.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I got back to... After I left, done with my judicial business, got back to Martley. Then I think they were all completely unofficial.
Oh, I see. And did you think the change was for the better? Or for the worse?
Oh, well, we used to find the village committees were a nuisance to us, of course.
In what way?
Well, I can't quite remember. I mean, obviously, I suppose, again, we would have liked it better had our own RMs in charge of them. But I think some of them used to have a trouble with their village committees, of course, as they were coming. But I mean, I can't. No, I mean, obviously, it was right to have village committees. I think my criticism, what I again thought was, if you put it this way, that what they really great lack in Sloan, what was a village committee, because there weren't such things. They were committees for the superior headman's divisions.
Oh, and I see. They were too large, do you think?
Well, perhaps they were a good thing to have, but I think we should have had, I think we might have had a sort of committee in each village or each headman's division.
A more intimate unit.
I think so. Well, I mean, you see, I'd go around and the people would complain to me, but nobody would repair their well, and I'd say, well, this is a village committee well, and they'll get on to your village committee. Oh, Sally Cunning, yeah, you see, they didn't care, and they only had one member, and perhaps he never went or something. So they couldn't really run the affairs of their own villages. I don't know, as I said before, my sort of idea is if they'd only started from the running their own villages and then gone up gradually, that's the way that self-government could have been developed better.
If I may say so, that was the idea when they had these Gansabas in 1870, and it would seem that somehow these people didn't quite fulfill their responsibility, and in effect the Gansabas became an instrument of the GA by default, more or less.
I didn't know. That it was a great pity, in a way. Perhaps it would have been better to let them go on and try and... Well, I see that, though, in a way. If they gave them too much power, I suppose the GA said... Well, I mean, one had to sort of see the things like the village wells and all those sort of things.
Did you have to keep pushing these committees to do things?
Yes, I think so. My recollection of them is that they weren't very
efficient.
Mm-hmm.
What about the tribunals?
Yes, of course,
that was different.
Yes, that was quite different. They were appointed presidents. And as a GA, one used to hear the appeals, yes.
Were there many?
Oh, yes, quite a fair number, yes.
What do you think of...
Practically none. From the GA to the governor.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the quality of their work?
I think, it was, as far as I remember, it was quite good. It would depend on the ordinary, it would depend on the individual community. Yes. It was an interesting sort of a constitution, it was rather interesting, because it was sort of quite separate from the ordinary courts. I mean, the appeals went up in an entirely different way. But of course, afterwards the GAs didn't do the appeals; they went to the district judges or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't you think that the GAs were in a better position to judge than a district judge or the AG?
The village cases.
Yes,
I should think so. Yes, mm-hmm. I don't think there was any. I don't think there was ever any sort of quarrel with that system. I think they were quite.
How useful were these tribunals?
Oh well, I think they were very necessary to try these sort of village cases.
Mm-hmm. Coming from that, and with respect to your judicial work, did you feel that in the police courts and the higher courts, this procedure and the whole system was far too formal and alien and even too sophisticated for most of the people?
Well, no, I don't think I ever quite thought of it in that way. I mean, that for a sort of not very sophisticated people, one should have had a simple
something on this village tribunal line.
I used to get very this isn't quite the answer to the question, I'm afraid, but my sort of looking back on job as a magistrate, what I've always felt was that it was much too much like playing a game according to rules that you didn't really, that one didn't, considering what a serious thing it is to try and prevent deal with crime, all these sort of rules that you couldn't hear a statement made. That's worse, I think, in Ceylon than in England, because in England, of course, you can hear a statement made to the police. In those days, you couldn't even, a statement made to the police couldn't be given in evidence.
Oh, I see.
And I felt that you were sort of playing a game according to rules, and that I must have let off people who were guilty and who could have been convicted under different procedure. But I wasn't thinking of it from the point of view of the actual people. I suppose it must have been a bit difficult for the ordinary bloke attending court and having his thing all interpreted into a language.
You see, as one aspect of it, don't you think the whole process was too cumbersome and too slow?
Well, it was certainly too slow,
especially considering the fact that the villager had to travel quite a distance and spend a lot of money to attend court.
Yes. It was certainly a frightful nuisance, I mean, for everybody, all this court business. But you mean that one could have done more? More could have been done by sort of village courts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Yes, I think that it is quite probable that it might have been better.
And secondly, when you were trying land disputes in particular, did you feel that many of your decisions were shot in the dark, and that really that there was more to it than was presented before you?
Well, you're talking about land cases, as a
specific. Yes. Okay.
Well, I didn't have very much of it, you see. Mm-hmm. The only time I was a civil judge was for a short time in Euralia.
Oh, I see.
District judge. And I can't remember much about the land cases or how it did work.
You see, the point I was working towards was the question whether British colonial rule had brought law rather than justice. Taking the system as a whole.
No, I should have thought it did bring justice. Well, on the whole. Mm-hmm. The trouble, of course, is it is so difficult to know who's speaking the truth when you're trying a case. I mean, they all
perfectly
in a natural way. It's not very easy to spot a liar. Whether it's easier in England, I don't know, whether they're less accomplished at lying. But that is the great snag, of course, there.
Jumping to another sphere, and especially your experience as A.G. Kudnagel and Martelet in the late 1930s, in connection with certain land matters, can you remember Brain's scheme of indivisible leaseholds?
Oh, yes.
Did you have to work this?
Oh, yes. That was all my career as a GA, that was always coming. The land development ordinance,
yes.
Allotments, yes.
What did you think of the idea?
When I left, it was beginning to become a bit unpopular, you know.
Yes, I know that.
For new land that was opened up, and these tanks and things, I think it was quite a sound idea. Where it was terribly tragic, really, was when a good state which had been running properly was sort of taken over and handed over to individuals, and all the value of the land sort of was lost, and they didn't run it properly. But on the whole, I suppose, it was a sound idea for people to own their own land.
But well, it's not a question of owning lands only, but it was a system where it was supposed to devolve on one person.
Yes.
And not get fragmented.
Yeah, yes, well, I think the idea of avoiding the fragmentation was a very sound one.
Yes, but was it practicable? I mean, do you know if the people got around these conditions in practice?
On the sort of small allotments,
yes,
they didn't. But of course, in the large allotments in the colonies, of course, I think what happened was that they very often they'd actually get them worked by somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't it possible to get them worked by three or four people in blocks and in effect fragmented? You know,
yes,
4 or 5 under 10.
I don't think it was that was actually divided up into blocks. I don't know, but what I found, of course, where there was more people needing land than anywhere else was when you started to hold a land country in one of these colonies. This is what I was thinking for Anuradhapura, you know,
mm-hmm.
Kalawawa, and all the colonies under there. All around the place, there were stacks of these people who were sort of the hangers-on of the allottees and who wanted land themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose to some extent, certainly there, I think to some extent they did get round it.
But didn't you, as an AGA, didn't you find it rather impracticable in that you found it very difficult to administer? Or didn't you find any particular difficulty in looking after these lots?
I don't think the actual sort of machinery of administration, I think that worked fairly well. But of course, if a person neglected his lot, you were supposed to turn him out in the end. Well, that was a question of how much neglect you could take and how you could force him to look after it. Well, all that was a bit of a...
I mean, didn't it involve a rather tedious amount of
time? It took a lot of time, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And they're holding these land cutteries, and then of course you had to collect the. Yes, it must have taken. Yes, I suppose it must have represented a fair expenditure in sort of office labour.
And didn't it bring you into contact with the peasantry in a rather odious manner, collecting fees and the despot, more or less?
Oh, I don't think so, no. The amount they had to pay was pretty small. No, you'd come round and look at their allotments and all that sort of thing. And no, I don't think in that way it was particularly awkward.
Another criticism has been regarding the definition of the word landless. Now, these lands, when you held a land country, you were supposed to give it to a chap who was landless. That is, the idea being that only poor people should get it. Correct?
Yes.
But I can quote examples and show that in certain villages, it was not the poor people who got it, but the fairly well-to-do, in that quite often they were the sons of some landowners, but being the sons, they didn't have any land. You see what I mean? And therefore they
yes.
came under the definition of the word landless.
Yes, there may be. Do you ever read the land manual?
No. By?
Well, it was our sort of the instructions on administering its ordinance. Of course, it did. You ought to try and get a copy. There must be some.
Oh, that would be interesting.
It tells you how you are where are to do it. But I think it did say sometimes that you weren't to go only for the. You've got to find somebody who's going to be able to work the land properly, rather than somebody who's just merely destitute.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But, there are no doubt abuses of the giving out of land, of land countries, the wrong people getting it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, on the whole, I think it sort of worked fairly well. You see, you get, you could always get, there was some room for appeal against mm-hmm. a decision. I don't think it very often happened. I think on the whole, it worked all right in the way of giving out the land, but whether the system was a good one or what would have been better is a matter of opinion. I think on the whole it did give a whole lot of people an opportunity to be fairly independent.
What about the land settlement department? As an AGA, did you find it a nuisance that the land settlement department was dealing with a village and that village was out of your hands, so to speak, because they
yes.
were...
I don't think it arose in Martley.
Oh,
I don't think it arose when I was in charge of a district. It arose when I was OA at Coronagla,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
What was the sort of thing that happened?
Closed, and I think it was liable to be a bit of a nuisance. Mm-hmm. Some question would come up, and they'd just say the village was closed, so you couldn't do anything about it.
What sort of question? I mean,
well, about the ownership of land, I think.
Mm-hmm. But couldn't you go into the village and deal with any cases of cattle trespass or any?
Oh yes. Oh, it was only the question of the ownership of land.
Oh, I see.
I think that somebody would say that there was a land dispute, and would we do something? Somebody send a petition. And then you'd be told it was closed. Well, you couldn't do anything then.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, I may be wrong, whether it was a nuisance, but I just remember the sort of you're trying to deal with something and then you're told it's closed, you couldn't do anything more about it. I mean, I don't think there's any particular, that was just as it happened. I don't know particular criticism of the thing, but I think it may have.
Have you any idea what the villagers' response to the settlement work was?
Land settlement work?
Mm. To the LSO. Did he grumble?
There was, of course, there were some crises about the settlement, I think, yes.
From the villagers?
Yes. But I was never in the department, so you ought to get that from the people who were in it.
When you were in the secretariat, for instance, in 1932, what were your spheres?
Oh, the military. Military, external, Maldive Islands. It was the least important ones, as far as I remember. Rather a mixed bag.
Jumping further ahead, post-war, did you feel that Ceylon was ready for independence, post-Second World War?
I don't know. It depends what we mean ready for independence. It has already got so much independence.
Now, did you feel that full independence as she got in 1948 should have been granted?
Well, looking back now, of course, I don't think it should, because of what happened as between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. If somehow some control had been kept, then we could have seen, I think, that the Tamils got a fair deal, which I reckon they didn't when the Sinhala-only business came in.
Mm-hmm. But,
I felt at the time that, I mean, we had these terrible massacres in India, that Ceylon was, and Burma, there was pretty good anarchy, wasn't there? Well,
mm.
That Ceylon was the place where it worked best.
Mm-hmm. How did you find working under the Ceylonese governments, the Sen Naika regime and especially, how did you find the work then? Was it very different?
No, well, you see, to a great extent I've been, as an AGA, you were working under the various ministers all through the Donemore time. So in that way, it wasn't really different, and I don't think I ever got into any sort of intolerable situations.
What about the Bandaranaike regime? What was the? Did you feel a difference between the period post 1956 and pre 1956? Personally,
I don't think that personally. I mean, as it affected me, I don't think it did really make much difference.
But for instance, as a GA, how did you? What were the channels through which you had communications with government? Which ministry were you under?
You communicated direct with the ministry concerned, you see, with each subject.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Now, did you feel, for instance, any lessening of efficiency in the Bandaranaike time as compared to the pre-Bandaranaike?
No, let's try and be fair about that. As regards how things
were done.
Worked with... No, I don't think it would be fair to say that there was any... that things were done in a less efficient way, or that as regards my administrations of the district, that anything was particularly made worse.
What about DSL Naika's administration? Didn't you feel that he rather fell off compared to his earlier performance?
What, when he became Prime Minister?
Yes.
No, I don't think I felt that. We, of course, I think when he first became Minister, he was, I think he was very intolerant, and in sort of personal matters, I think he lost a lot of good men from his ministry by, well, I suppose... It was,
from civil service?
Well, yes, well, from the government service. Well, I can think of there's a man called Wilson who was director of irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
They had a clash and lost. And then there was Crawford the vet, who was a good man. And he had a loss. Of course, it was more difficult in those days because people... Of course, he had a violent quarrel with Kennedy, who was the most brilliant man who's ever been in the irrigation department, and I think it's the real author of the Galloia. But
Paul Kennedy, you were difficult to get on with.
Paul Kennedy was he became an alcoholic, so he was lost. But what was very difficult. But of course, it was partly the changeover of conditions. It did create a difficult situation, and these people like Kennedy, you see, he knew that he was an expert at irrigation. He knew his answer well from an irrigation. The quarrel with Kennedy and Senaki was about the, I don't know whether you know Polnareua tank,
yes,
which was restored.
Yes.
But Kennedy said that this isn't the proper answer at all. The proper answer is to dam the, whether the, that river comes through the range of mountains.
Yes, Alutnoura, yes.
No, not Alutnoura. It's this, where the Suduganga comes through a range of hills, somewhere between, up above, you see, instead of building all that great tank again. And I think they'll come round to that eventually. I don't know whether they've done it yet, but they will probably have to as well as Polnareua. And of course, naturally, Senanaki wanted this restoration of the Topawa, where the old glories of Ceylon. I think they had a fight about that. And of course, Kennedy couldn't realize this state of affairs where somebody who knew nothing about it should have the power of overriding him. Mm-hmm. But that's the sort of thing, and I think Senaki was intolerant there. But I admired him as a prime minister, and I thought he was the... I didn't think he fell off, but...
What about Dudley? And well, Sir John, what did you think of their performance?
Oh, does all this get quoted? Well, that's rather modern history.
Oh,
well,
both alive, of course.
Yes. Well, of course, poor Dudley, when he started as Prime Minister, I think he hadn't got the strength he gave up, didn't he?
Well, he didn't want to be Prime Minister.
No. But I'm hoping that he's doing well now. Now, Cottle is not the ideal Prime Minister type, I don't think. At least he could go round and to Jaffna and everywhere and be welcomed, which is more than Senanaike could do. Mm-hmm. But Senanaike, of course, did keep the country together, and he had what was called the United National Party. That's why I always feel that Ceylon should be a country, and it wasn't one under the Senanaike regime. It was two warring races.
Yes. Did you feel that Senanaike, in the 1930s, for instance, that he had a chip on his shoulder, even then?
Yes, I think so, yes.
Anti-European?
Oh yes, I think so, definitely.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel this yourself when you were under him as Prime Minister?
No.
Mm-hmm. What about political interference in his time? Did it increase? That's a general impression one gets.
Political interference with the administration?
Yes. Even more so than before.
Perhaps I was lucky. I don't think it particularly affected me.
Mm-hmm. One thing I hadn't asked you about was the cooperative credit movement, which Campbell started.
Oh, yes.
I mean, did you have anything to do with it as AGA?
Well, yes, one was used to come up against it. I'll tell you one thing which struck me very much. That in Campbell's time, everybody, all the people who'd have to go around to all the villages and talk to them and explain the whole thing in their own language.
Yes.
But later on, when I was at Batticaloe, long after, they all came down, they all had to have interpreters.
Oh, these were Sinhalese?
Yeah, Sinhalese ones, and they had to interpret it in Tamil. Of course, I think Campbell did very, he was very keen on the thing and got it going. I think it became a sort of political thing afterwards. So.
Political? What do you mean?
Well, wasn't it? Yes, of course, they started these cooperative...
Wholesale?
Yes. They started, yes. I don't think those were altogether a good thing. I don't think they were. I think they gave up the real fundamental concepts of cooperation and made these things as a sort of rather political.
What do you mean by the fundamental?
Well, I don't quite know. I don't know enough about cooperation. But I know I have spoken to people in the cooperative society. It's a cooperative department, I mean. And I think there is no... I think they weren't run on proper cooperative lines,
mm-hmm.
but I can't tell you exactly what a proper cooperative lines are. But I think if you've got on to somebody who was in the department and who was really knew about cooperation, they could point out the things. I can't quite remember much about them now, but I'm sure that they didn't really work properly. They sort of ran them as against the traders.
Yes, I see. Now, I was especially thinking about the cooperative societies in the 1920s and 1930s when they were starting it. Have you any idea what the peasant response to this was? I mean, it was supposed to help them.
Yes. No, I don't think I really know very much about it. Come in.
Oh, Daddy, sorry, could you please cut the cake? I can't.
Oh, bring it in here and we'll cut it.
Okay.
What about the marketing department, rural marketing, and Bassett? What sort of man was Bassett?
Oh, well, he was a good, quite a great friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And then he was done after us by Tennyson, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. He was very keen, I know, on this.
Yes, I think he did quite a lot of good. Mm-hmm. But none of these things quite the sort of panaceas that people hope they'll be. I think it always used to be the idea that the middleman was an absolute scoundrel and was making colossal profits.
Yes.
Then I think when government started to do these things, they found that their overheads were pretty heavy.
Yes.
And that's only a sort of rather general observation, but I don't know quite how true it is. But I think something like that.
You think even Campbell and Bassett and them, when they were starting these things, they were over-optimistic and...
I don't know about Campbell. Campbell's great idea was to start these societies so that people would be able to get money without becoming
indebted
to these chetties and people. Mm-hmm. And I should think, in as far as it went, I should think it did good, but I don't know how far it did succeed or how many people were taken into it.
To jump to another topic, you mentioned Bernard Alihare, and were there any other politicians you came across in the 1930s?
1930s, he was the one I... Well, I went to Marley in 1937, and I was there until 1944.
Oh, I see.
So he was there all the time. There was another person who came into a part of the district wasn't he Nugawella, I think.
Oh, I see. Yes. Was Alihara a capable sort?
Oh, yes, he was an able sort. I think he was, and he was very likeable and had a sense of humour, and I got on quite well. I imagined that I think he was rather excitable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was terribly stable.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very keen. I think he did a lot. He used to have similar ideas about trying to improve Martley District and the irrigation, which was rather neglected. I think really, sort of between us, we managed to do that good.
You felt that between the...
Well, I think we worked in together pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And
those things.
And... how did he compare with Nugawella? Or rather, how did Nugawella compare with him?
Well, I didn't remember Nugawella nearly so much. He only sort of came into a very small part of the district. I think he only came... It was up the sort of... He was Wattigama or somewhere, I don't know what it was called, the electorate, and just a very small bit of it came into my district. Then I had Trinco, I had I can't remember his name. He was a long hair and rather not particularly prepossessing looking person. But
what about George E. De Silva? Did you know him?
George?
Candy chap.
George, oh yes, yes. The famous George, yes, I knew him. God, I quite liked him personally too.
You were talking about local self-government, and I was thinking, how did the Kandy Council work?
Are you going to...
No, I was wondering whether you felt that gave any training in local self-government, Kandy Council.
Or
the Municipal Council.
Oh, I see. Oh, I don't know really much about that.
Because I mean, there's a great difference between these urban and municipal councils and these village committees.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
I was always, I suppose, more interested in the rural areas and mm-hmm. towns. You know, who was the first mayor of Camden was Roger Whitehorn. He's still somewhere about.
He's in London.
Yes. I saw him. You've got a knife for us to spread our butter.